history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really need to be preserved. We cannot let them go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. One of the most unbelievable and incredible stories from all of World War II is the tale of the USS Indianapolis, the worst naval disaster our country endured in those years and perhaps ever. And one of the last survivors from that ship is our guest today in Benicia, California. That's the correct pronunciation. I have it on good authority from 93-year-old Harold Bray, a longtime police officer here in Benicia. But you're not from these parts. You're from a much colder climate. What was your hometown in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan?
It's called Ramsey, Michigan, R-A-M-S-A-Y. I don't know where the name come from, but it was a mining town, iron ore mining town. That's what they all were at that time. My dad worked in the underground for 35 years there.
And your father was a veteran of World War One, the British Army?
Yeah, British Army, yeah.
Did he ever tell you any stories about his time in uniform?
No, he never elaborated on any. Just we knew that he was there, but never told anything. I guess they were all like that, though, the First World War. It was so bad they didn't want to talk about it, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and many of your generation have been the same way.
Yeah.
And your story is so unique, and the story of your ship is so captivating. There are many books that have been written about it, movies that have been made about it. But I want to hear about this boy. So you were the second of four children?
Yes, two brother and two sisters, yeah.
So what was life, other than cold, what was life like growing up there?
That's all we knew. We were born and raised there. We thought the world was like that, but the Navy changed my mind. Things were sure different from when I was raised. It was such a close thing. The whole town was just brother and sister, you know. And I enlisted in the Navy. That changed everything.
Well, and before you enlisted in the Navy, there were a few years that you were waiting to do so, as I understand, because you were only 14 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Do you have memories of that day, of December 7th?
Somebody's told me Pearl Harbor was attacked. I don't know. Where was Pearl Harbor? So that's where we started there. We didn't even know what was outside of Ramsey. Your 10-mile radius was pretty far in those days. And everybody didn't have a car. When you went, you walked or wherever you went. But when the war started, things really changed for us.
Did you see friends of yours that were signing up right away?
Yeah, everybody was anxious to go. You know, I had to wait 3 years before I could enlist. I turned 17, and my dad was right there with the pen.
Well, and why was it so important to you to serve your country, to join the Navy? Where did that come from?
Well, mostly all my friends were older than me, and they were all enlisting. I couldn't wait to be 17. I was still in high school. I got to the 12th grade, and I got into December, and I finally got my dad talked into signing me in. And I got in and went to Great Lakes for a boot camp. At that time, we had 3 months of boot camp, I think, 3 or 4 months of boot camp, and went straight from boot camp to the ship.
Was boot camp challenging for you?
It was different.
Yeah?
The way I was brought up, kind of family close, you know, I enlisted, there was nothing but guys. Everybody was going at that time. There's nobody holding your hand. I mean, you just did what you were told, and you better do it right the first time. But it was the way I was raised, that's how I was raised, and it wasn't too hard to get used to it in a service, to do what you're told to do, and no questions asked, you know, you just had to do it. You ate better, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
Where we were in northern Michigan, it was, I look back at it, we were brought up pretty poor. Everybody worked in the mines, and there wasn't much money, so we just lived with it. We learned a lot by being raised like that.
Didn't take anything for granted.
No. Well, as soon as I got in the Navy, it was a big change to be living like that. Never ate so good. That's what I remember most about it, getting to boot camp and his table full of food. I couldn't understand where that came from.
Had you had any experience on the water before you joined the Navy?
Well, we live by Lake Superior there, and we had a place on a lake. We had 20 acres on Lake Ogibek, which was about 30 miles from the home. But we were always around water. Yeah. We had rafts and boats and made our own stuff. Yeah. But it was interesting growing up. Looking back on it, it was a good learning experience every day. It was different. It was always different. Nothing was there for you. You had to make your own way of life, you know. Even as close as our family was, it was always trying to push you out, learning yourself, you know. And I never regretted any of it. It was good for me to grow up that way. I appreciate what I have today because of that. The war was on by the time I got to like 13, 14, mm-hmm. and everybody was going, and everything was changing. The way of life was changing from the close-knit family to everything was spread out. You know, it was just a learning experience. Almost every day was different, and I couldn't wait to get into service.
I was struck in thinking about your story. If the Indianapolis isn't hit by a kamikaze at Okinawa, it's not back here in California for you to get aboard
no.
and take the components of the nuclear bomb to Tinian, yeah. and then everything that happened after that. But when you first laid eyes on that heavy cruiser, the Indianapolis, what was your first impression?
I couldn't believe it was a monster ship. We were in a dry dock when I got there, and it was almost as long as the dry dock. It was 700 feet or something like that. It was really amazing. Everything after that was all new to me. It was just amazing. I just enjoyed the whole thing because I was away from home and on my own. It was a good time for me.
You're a youngster. You're 18 years old. Were there older guys on the ship?
Oh,
who
yeah.
kind of took you under their wing?
Well, matter of fact, Pappy Goff, he was older, and somehow, some reason, hooked up with me and brought me along pretty good. As far as the ship goes, he made sure I was didn't get into trouble, and I learned a lot from him. We were in the water together after that, too, so, you know, he lived through that. You grew up pretty fast.
But something else happened at Mare Island, right here in the East Bay. The Indianapolis received some pretty important cargo.
Well, we didn't know what it was. Well, the skipper didn't even know what it was. We're still in dry dock. Matter of fact, I was out on liberty, and we got a call back. Everybody from Vallejo, Indianapolis, get back to the ship right away. And we didn't know what for. We stopped at Hunter's Point, and that's when we picked up the bomb, I guess. We didn't know what it was until we didn't know until we were in a hospital in the Philippines that we had carried the bomb.
So what did you see at the time? It was just a giant crate they were craning on or something?
I remember in a port hangar, and it had Marine guards around it. You couldn't even touch the thing. We walked through the hangar deck, and the Marines had guns and everything. Couldn't even touch the box it was on. It's bigger than the table there. It seemed, I remember right, about 8 feet by 4 feet or something. It was big. Anyhow, we couldn't see it. We couldn't even touch the grate. So the Marines were the guns, you know.
So you must have known that it was important in some fashion if they're going to have Marines guarding it.
Yeah, well, even, like I said, the skipper didn't even know what he had until we delivered it. Of course, we didn't know until we dropped it.
Until you survived the ordeal you went through.
Yeah.
But I have heard a few stories over the years that aboard ship, and you have almost 1,200 men on ship,
yes, right.
that there was some scuttlebutt about what may be in that crate, and that maybe even guys were betting on what it would be.
A lot of guessing, yeah. Mostly about girls, though.
There were some girls inside of there?
No. I don't know. Guys are crazy, you know. I don't remember any of the stuff that I ever said was in there, but I walked by it many times. You couldn't even get near it. And they didn't know what they were guarding. They didn't know what it was.
I heard some people thought it was a bunch of beer in there.
Oh, well, that was guessed too, yeah. Bunch of beer. We could have drank that beer too.
I think you would have been willing to drink just about anything when you were in the water for 4.5
days. Yeah, I could have used a few beers those days.
Well, what about for you? So I'm curious, you specifically, since you're 18 and this is your very first journey on this ship.
Yeah.
So you guys leave here and you deliver those components to Tinian. What was that journey like? Were there any experiences along the way that stand out?
Well, being on that ship, and my first ship ever, big or small, sitting on a fantail and watching, we were doing 35 knots. I couldn't believe we were moving that fast. That big old, this thing is a big ship, doing 35 knots. It was a really experience for me. Of course, you couldn't even write home and tell about it because all your mail was special. I mean, everything. My mother would get a letter from me with everything crossed out. I couldn't tell her nothing. It was a big experience for me, but lucky to live through it.
And your role on the ship, were you a ship fitter? Is that right?
Yeah, I was a striker,
Trying to become a ship fitter.
Yeah, yeah.
So that meant you would have repair jobs, hypothetically?
Repair a ship, yeah. Well, even we worked on the job, but we never held a rating. When you enlist, you don't write what you could do and couldn't do. And I ended up a ship fitter because I was mechanically inclined or something. It wasn't very long, though.
And what about if general quarters sounded? Where would your battle station be?
Well, I was a number 3 turret. I was of 8-inch guns. I was a loader. I never got to fire them. I threw the 3 bags of powder and then projectile. Mm-hmm. I seen them load. I never got to do it myself. I carried the powder bags, but that was it.
And before you took off, or even en route, did you have a concept of the significance of the submarine threat and that you guys might be susceptible to that?
They didn't tell us too much, but they didn't want to scare us, I guess. Because they just got back from being hit, and they blew a number 1 and number 2 turret was blown right off the ship, I guess. So that was why she was in Maryland. They replaced the turrets and all the guns, and she took quite a hit off of Okinawa.
So you guys get to Tinian, and you see them unload this precious cargo, this top-secret package.
Yeah. We didn't know what it was, though. We didn't know till we got in a hospital in the Philippines what we had, what we did.
And when you're leaving Tinian, as I understand it, McVeigh requested an escort and was denied?
And he refused.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need one.
Didn't need one because there shouldn't be any submarines where you're going.
Well, they figured we could outrun any sub. She was pretty fast.
Yeah.
But you didn't know a sub was around, so she shot us third day out of Tinian.
Well, and I think we need to catch our first break before we dive into the events of July 30th, 1945. The USS Indianapolis had stopped at Guam after delivering to Tinian the components of Little Boy, the bomb that would shock the world when dropped from the Enola Gay over Hiroshima a week later. At Guam, there were some sailors who had completed their tours and transferred off the ship, replaced by new members of the Indy crew who had no idea that the decorated cruiser was about to enter into the worst sea disaster in the history of the U.S. Navy. Where was Harold Bray when 2 Japanese torpedoes struck the ship just after midnight on the 30th of July, 75 years ago? Where would he usually have been? And how in the world did that 18-year-old survive the better part of 5 days in the water? Only 8 survivors of the USS Indianapolis remain on this 75th anniversary, and we have the privilege of hearing from one of them today. If you'd like to learn about the others and dig into the bigger picture of the USS Indianapolis and its legacy, head over to ussindianapolis.com. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. Since COVID-19 is preventing the survivors from gathering in Indianapolis this year as they typically would, there instead is a 3-day virtual reunion online. So check that out at ussindianapolis.com. And on July 29th, 2020, Chief of Naval Operations Mike Gilday sent a message to all of our current U.S. fleet, asking them to observe not just a moment of silence, but 12 minutes of silence. That's the time it took for that mighty vessel to sink in the Philippine Sea. It's taken all of these 75 years for the depth of this incredible story to fully flesh itself out, and we'll share the latest edition on that front when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.